13 past 10 is the time, and the small agricultural township of Carnamar is in WA's Midwest region, about 300 k's north of Perth and about, I suppose, 100 k's from the coast, southeast of Dongara. The town was gazetted in 1913, but the early European settlers leased pastoral land there as far back as 1861. Well, Carnamar has one of the best documented histories. In fact, I would go as far as to say the best documented history in Australia, certainly on a website available to the public. And that's thanks to an extremely passionate historical society, and especially one member, Andrew Bowman, who joins us on the program now. We've just discovered, and Andrew's actually in Sydney, so it's 1:15 in the morning over there. But he's very kindly agreed to join us. How are you going, Andrew?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, mate, and lovely to talk to you. And, well, it just underlines your passion, I think, the fact that you're prepared to stay up until that time of the night to talk to us. But and the town, is there any plans for centenary celebrations this year, seeing it's the centenary of gazetting?
Absolutely. The town actually turns 100. I think the gazetting date is in April, but we're celebrating the centenary in conjunction with the local show, which is on the between the 13th and the 15th of September.
Oh, okay, so that'll kind of be a back to Carnamar weekend in some ways.
Absolutely, the show sort of is to a degree anyway, so it will sort of be times two.
Okay, well, it had quite a history, or the area did, prior to the gazetting of the town, as I mentioned. For 50-odd years prior to that, there were pastoralists and graziers in the area, and I think the first to take up pastoral leases were Duncan McPherson and George Slater in 1861, just as graziers. At that stage, they didn't live there.
Yeah, they both took up or jointly took up pastoral leases. The McPhersons were actually based in Newcastle, which is now better known as 2J.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, even though they didn't live there, they did actually run livestock through the district at that time.
Uh-huh.
And then about 7 years later, after almost going bankrupt and being evicted from the property they were leasing, they thought, what are we going to do now? So they moved to the middle of nowhere.
Okay. And by then, of course, there was already one settler in the area we now know as Carnamar, and that was James Nan and his family, who I think settled there in 1866.
Yeah, they may have actually settled there a little bit earlier, but we know that they were definitely there by 1866 because Mrs. Nan gave birth to a son there, so that's sort of undisputable proof that they were definitely there by that date.
Okay. And they established, I think it's Noolaloo, their station?
Yeah, named after a freshwater spring of the same name, which is an Aboriginal name. We unfortunately don't know exactly what it means.
Okay. Yeah, well, a lot of those around. But, yeah, there are a few springs, thankfully, up around that area, which, of course, allowed pastoralists to run sheep and cattle up there. I think Noolaloo was about 33,000 acres, so a pretty sizable lease. And that, I think, was later taken over by Nan's son, Frank. I think that's what happened.
Eventually, yeah, James, so the Nan family were only actually there for a couple of years, and they then moved further north to Dongara, which at that time was a more established district. But yeah, their son Frank stayed on managing the property, and he ended up actually having a child with a daughter of William Long of nearby Carew Station, but then ended up marrying her sister a few years later.
Okay. All right, so the other one, of course, we mentioned was Duncan McPherson, and he, in many ways, was kind of the father of Carnamar, and I guess he and his family, they were there for a long, long time. They, as you said, came from 2J, where they'd been for about 20 years, and he had a wife and 8 children, I think.
Yeah.
And they established, firstly, a property near Yarra Yarra Lakes, and just a small, a 3-room cottage for a family of 10.
Yeah, I don't know how that works, but there was, about 10 of them, the 8 children and the parents. They lived in initially in a quite small cottage, and then they later built, a couple of years later, they built a very large homestead next to Carnamar Spring, which is after which their property, and later the town and district takes its name.
Uh-huh. So, and that expanded, I think, in the end, with his sons, some of his sons being involved, to something like 120,000 acres. So it was a hell of a big property. And that was that became Carnamar Station, I think.
Yeah, most of present-day Carnamar, they held in pastoral leases. except obviously for the portion held by the Nan family. And Bishop Salvado of New Norcia actually had sort of the residue of what was left.
What did he do for workers, Andrew? I know he had a number of children, but that's a big property to look after when you're running stock on it as well.
The station was actually an official ration station for Aboriginal people, so they were legally allowed to employ Aboriginal people, and they also did actually employ a number of ticket of leave convicts.
Okay. And the relationship with the Aboriginal people was harmonious?
From what we can tell, it was reasonably harmonious. We've actually recently pieced together that Duncan McPherson did actually father two Aboriginal children during the earlier 1860s, when the family had pastoral leases in the district but weren't actually living there full time.
Okay. Well, that wasn't unusual for pastoralists either.
No, it wasn't.
No, there's been it wasn't normally talked about, but certainly there have been many examples of pastoralists fathering children with Aboriginal women who may have been working in the homestead or whatever the case may be. Now, McPherson also took on other roles, didn't he? When the Telegraph arrived in Carnamar, I think it was based in their home, and he also had the mail run up around that area.
Oh, yeah, so when the Telegraph line went through in 1874, which isn't that long after they'd probably finished building their homestead, the Telegraph line actually went via their homestead purposefully so it could be a telegraph station, and then that was housed in an outbuilding and run by one of Duncan's daughters. And Duncan was the contractor for quite a few years for the mail to be delivered between Perth and Geraldton, which went, I think, about to Berkshire Valley by sort of with a horse and cart, and then the rest of the way just on horseback.
Okay. What do we know about Duncan McPherson as a man?
Not a lot, really. I guess he's one of those people where he died in 1898, so there's not a lot of, I guess, opportunities to find out things about personality. But he seems to have been a very successful pastoralist and obviously businessman as well to sort of establish himself and his family again after going bankrupt. He seems to have taken pretty good care of his family. His Aboriginal son actually worked with the family on the station, so I think that sort of says something as well.
And he was a Scotsman, wasn't he?
He and his wife were born in Scotland, and their eldest son, and then their they actually originally went to South Australia, and their second son was born on the way sailing across to WA, and then the rest were all born in 2J.
In 2J, okay. Well, for nearly 25 years, the McPhersons and the Nans were the only settlers in the Carnamar area, and then, of course, came the idea to build a railway from Midland to, walk away, inland a little from Geraldton. In doing that, the private company, the Midland Railway Company, were given the rights to sell land along the line to basically finance the construction and operation of the railway. And so it went pretty much right through Carnamar, and the siding that was built there was called Carnamar. How did that change things in the town? Because, there was no town at that stage, was there?
No, there was no town. So, like you say, there were sort of just the two families running pastoral operations, wheat, cattle and horses. The railway going through in 1894 meant that most of the land that they'd actually held in pastoral leases from the government was then actually owned by the Midden Railway Company. So they both families actually then started leasing some of the same land from the company. But it did sort of, I guess, mark the dawn of sort of pastoral stations sort of in Carnamar anyway, being broken down.
Yeah, the very large ones, into smaller farms. But McPherson also had a fair bit of land on the western side of the railway line. I think most of the land that the Midland Railway Company had to sell was on the eastern side. So while he had some on the eastern side, he also had a fair bit on the western side, which he was able to retain.
They managed to... the Midden Railway, I think their terms for a lot of the railway were that they were actually only allowed to take up land on one side of the railway line.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, the the McPhersons did, I guess, were fortunate that they already had pastoral leases, which they eventually transitioned into conditional purchase on the other side of the railway line. So they still ended up with a reasonable property.
Now, as I say, there was no town. Was there anything there when the rail started to run? Was there a, you know, like a general store or a guest house or anything like that?
No, there was just the McPherson's homestead is very close to where the Carnamar town site now is, but other than that, there wasn't anything. Then the railway station was built around 1894, and then within a couple of years, because the railway sort of transformed the district, it went from this place that was literally considered in the middle of nowhere, very difficult to get to. The railway sort of removed the remoteness from the equation. And then you actually did have more small-scale farmers taking up residence in the district. You then had people coming in and felling sandalwood trees and that kind of thing. And then that sort of, the population did start to grow a little bit. A school was then established in 1912 and then the town was gazetted in 1913.
Okay, oh, I just wonder about the school. So 1912, you say?
And the first general store was around the same time.
Okay, so the railway, there would have been railway people based there, I guess. They usually had a station master or something and maybe maintenance, you know, track maintenance staff.
Yeah, there was a ganger and a team of fettlers, I think, established from Carnamar fairly early on after the railway opened.
Okay, so you mentioned the old man McPherson, Duncan, died in 1898, and I think two of the sons, George and Donald, took over the property, and they'd started breeding horses for export, didn't they?
They bred horses for two reasons. One was to export to India, and the other reason was they actually bred race horses as well.
Okay.
The family seems to have been one of those old pastoralist families that were very heavily into horse racing, and they actually had a very successful racehorse for a number of years that raced in Perth and on the goldfields that was named Carnamar.
Oh, okay. And how did they get them to India? I mean, how did they get them from Carnamar to, I suppose they would have gone out through Fremantle on ship?
They would have railed them so far, and prior to the railway, they actually would have herded them overland.
Just driven them down. Oh, goodness me.
Which is what they did with sheep and cattle as well.
Yeah, so I think then they were running sheep and cattle and some timber as well. They were taken out, as you said, the sandalwood. I think there might have been other timber coming out of there.
They also cut timber in Carnamar, which they carted to Kew, the use in the Great Fingal Mine, which I think it was used to sort of line the shafts and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So sort of quite diverse operation, really.
Yeah. And George died in 1904, which left Donald as the sole owner, but there were two of the sisters, Margaret and Elizabeth, or Bessie, I think she was known as, who were unmarried. So they continued to live in the homestead as well. They reduced the size of the property a little bit as well, but stayed there for a long, long time. The Nans, meanwhile, I think were into, by this time, a third generation. Edward and Harold had taken over. But in 1908, they moved to Nanine, was it?
They ended up buying the lease to Yarrabubba Station in Nanine, so then they actually disposed of the sort of residual property that their family had in Carnamar.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually then sold that to a Perth accountant, and he put his brother-in-law on the property as manager.
Okay, and some new farmers started to take up land by that time, and I think it was during the First World War, I think, Andrew, I read that the first wheat was grown. Of course, it became a very productive wheat-growing area in subsequent years, but was it Arthur Darling? Was that the guy who was the first to try growing wheat in the area?
The McPhersons had grown wheat and other grains as well for hay and chaff, but the first person to grow wheat on a large scale was most definitely Arthur Darling, and he sort of went into it in a big way relatively quickly. Back then, 1,000 or 2,000 acres, which now isn't considered much at all, but at the time it was a very, very considerable amount of crop.
Yeah, it would have been, well, particularly if you were relying on you know, horses or whatever to seed it and harvest it and prepare the ground would have been hard yakka. Now the land sales from the Midland Railway Company wasn't really a great success, was it? They sold very little of the land, and they needed to do that to finance the railway. So in 1910 they started, and I saw some ads on the website, fantastic ads that they placed in newspapers and magazines, I think not only in Australia but a lot of them in England and Scotland as well, for what they called ready-made farms, 400-acre farms which were partly cleared and fenced, and I think they even built houses on them.
They're actually mostly marketed abroad, so mostly to the British in, as you say, England, Scotland, also India as well. And the idea was they weren't managing to sell any of their virgin land in Carnamar, so their land agent, which was James Gardner in Perth, just thought, well, maybe if we actually transforming it into farms, we can then not only sell the land but sell it for a lot more money. So they did, which was a pretty ambitious thing to do. So they had a huge number of land clearers up in the district, clearing the bush, erecting fences, and as you say, also getting houses built as well. And it's an interesting concept. It did initially seem to be quite successful. Quite a number of people quickly started buying the farms, and not only that, but immigrating to Western Australia to settle on them. But it soon very quickly started turning sour when the farmers started to realise that they may have been misled over a few profitability factors, and they were also maybe never going to earn enough money to be able to pay their repayments.
So basically they'd paid far too much for them.
Yeah, they were on 20-year terms, so they had a lot of time to pay for them. And I guess they'd paid the deposit and were then thinking they'd earn the rest, which is obviously sort of the proposition that the company had sold them to. Necessarily the company wasn't meaning to be misleading about that. I think they were as devastated as the farmers were, but they had been a little bit misleading with some of their advertisements. I think statements like practically droughtless, despite there being a drought a few years earlier, were possibly a little bit immoral.
Yeah, I must say, when I read the spiel on the advertisement, I thought that doesn't quite sound like the Carnamara that I know. I wouldn't quite describe the rainfall there as particularly reliable. Maybe it was a little more then than it is now. Now, I think there are about 20 families bought them, and most of them were from Scotland, as you said. One of them was your own, Andrew.
Yes, my great-grandfather was among them. He actually came out from Scotland with two other families. Three families had been involved in the coal mining industry and decided that they wanted a warmer climate and obviously a change of pace, so they moved out to WA. I don't know that it was what they expected, which seems to have been a very common thread amongst all of the ready-made farm settlers. I think a lot of them got quite a massive shock when they arrived.
That they fought over that, didn't they? In fact, the amount that they'd paid for the properties, and they said, look, you know, we just can't make this work economically. We either you reduce the price, or we're just going to have to walk off. And I think in the end, they got something like a 40% reduction in what they'd paid for the properties, and I guess under that, they were able to make them viable operations, and thereby most of them stayed. Now, as we mentioned, the town site wasn't gazetted until 1913. That's about the time that those families began to arrive. And at that stage, I think there was a Davison's General Store and one house in what we now know as Carnamar.
So there wasn't very little at all. There was one of the local railway settlers, which was Henry Parkin. He'd built a small house in Carnamar. And, as you say, there was one general store to go along with it. So,
and the school, I guess.
The school was actually located a short distance out of what we would now call the Carnamar town site. So I guess initially there was no town, so things were just sort of getting put where people thought they should. And then after the town was gazetted, obviously it was a little bit more formulated as to where things went.
Now, like most communities in Australia, probably in the world, World War One had an impact. I think about 30 men from Carnamar, from the area, and there weren't that many more there, went away to the war, and I think 9 of them were killed. So that's about a 30% loss there. But at the end of World War One, there was a repatriation system with soldiers, and they instituted a soldiers' settlement scheme up around Carnarvon, making the farms a lot smaller, but lots of new farms, and that led to a major increase in the population, and the town really started to go ahead, and the district, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. It really, the Repatriation Department actually created 4 soldier settlement estates in Carnarvon and Winchester, which is southern Carnarvon. And, massive difference. All of a sudden, within, you know, a 3-year period, 40 new families took up farms. And obviously with all of those families came heaps of farmhands and clearers and contractors as well. So the population went from really quite small and almost what you would call a settlement, more than a district and a town, went, you know, sort of almost blossomed overnight.
Yeah, well, during that period, I think you got another general store, the hall, the bakery, a pub finally in 1924, and other things, butchers, garage, tea rooms, even their own power station, all started to happen in the 1920s. So it certainly turned from a an agricultural backwater in lots of ways into a quite thriving little community.
Yeah, the town is often, there's been a number of references that we've encountered over the past couple of years where they've actually referred to the town like a field of mushrooms where it sort of just sprung up overnight after the rains. So, and it does seem to actually be a lot of validity to that claim, especially in the later 20s. The town just sort of just surged ahead, where you had all these houses being built and new shops opening and new tea rooms opening. And then a couple of years later, Carnarvon had its own newspaper, police station. So it was an extremely well-appointed town in the early 1930s, had a chemist, doctor, solicitor even.
Mm. And it broke away from, I think originally it was in the Upper Irwin Roads Board, but I think in the mid-20s, Carnarvon broke away and established its own roads board, and I'd be very surprised if a McPherson or two wasn't involved in that.
Yeah, so after quite a bit of campaigning, I guess once the district was sort of on its own 2 feet, they sort of thought, well, we want our own road board or own local government. And yeah, 1923 they broke away and they took 3 springs with them. And then I think they stole Peru from one of the other road boards to the south, and then they formed their own. Interestingly enough, now obviously, as you probably know, they're talking about pushing all the local government areas back together, so we could see a reversal sometime soon, maybe.
Yeah, but not if the people get their way, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
The telephone arrived, I think, around that time as well, and I think I read today that your great-great-grandfather was the first farmer to have one?
Yes, he. I guess through luck of being an earlier settler, his farm wasn't all that far from town, so it was probably not overly expensive for him to be connected. Back then, that meant that you had to run your own telephone line from the town to your farm, so geographical location probably had a lot to do with that,
yeah.
I would think.
Just tie it to the fence and use it as the top strand. During that period of growth, the rest of the Midland Railway land was sold as well, and as you suggested, wheat then started to become a major industry in the area. And by the end of the 1920s, Carnarvon had pretty much every service that a town could need, as you outlined. So it was quite quick when it really started to happen. I saw on the website the list of sporting clubs. I mean, I know you've been through all the newspapers and noted down just about everything that ever happened during that time, and in small communities. You know, anything that happened in town would make the local paper, so it's very well documented. But what happened during the Depression? Because wheat prices really crashed, didn't they?
Yeah, I think wheat prices almost crashed overnight, and you actually had the quite dire situation where farmers put in their crops, which actually grew well and yielded well, and they then delivered them their grain at the end of harvest and made a financial loss. And farmers were actually faced with this for consecutive years. And a lot of them, there were a couple who were forced to abandon their farms. But I guess one of the other outcomes of that is that the district had very much become a wheat-growing district, and a lot of the soldier settlers that had come, and even some of the ready-made farmers as well, they were solely wheat-growing concerns. So all they were doing was growing wheat. So it did make a lot of the farmers become a little bit more diverse. Some of them started then introducing livestock such as sheep and cattle. And then in 1933, we actually had barley being grown for the first time in Carnarvon as well.
Okay. And so, all that diversity spread around the wheat belt, didn't it, really? And, wheat and sheep for many, many years went hand in hand. It's not so much the case now as the farms have got bigger and bigger and as the technology's got better. And they find that they just take their chances with wheat, but the droughts still come, and there are good seasons and there are not so good seasons. Now, Donald McPherson died in 1931 at the age of 73, and he had not married, and neither had a couple of his sisters, and I think the last of them was Elizabeth, or Bessie, as we mentioned, who was 87 when she died in 1939. Were there other descendants? Is the McPherson family still represented?
Yeah, there are still descendants around. Most of their children, surprisingly, never married. So the last four McPhersons to live in the homestead were Donald and George and Bessie and Elizabeth. I mean, the four of them never married, and they all lived out their lives at the homestead. And there were a couple of other siblings who didn't marry, but there were two brothers who moved further north to other pastoral pursuits, and they did marry, so there's still descendants around. And also there are probably a great number of Aboriginal people who are actually descended from the family as well. And interestingly enough, when Donald McPherson died, at the very end of his funeral report, where it lists, you know, all the people who attended and all the people who left floral tributes, there's actually about eight names at the very end of the list which were actually local Aboriginal families. And obviously it wasn't known or mentioned at the time, but quite a few of them would have actually been relatives of his.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, I'm not surprised they didn't marry, because the choice would have been a nan or a nan, really, wouldn't it? when they were sort of at that marrying age, there was no one else for bloody, 100 miles around.
Yeah, there definitely would have been a lot of social isolation, for sure.
Now, in World War II, there was a bit of a dad's army in Carnarvon.
Yeah, at the sort of the outbreak of war, they actually did form a militia unit in Carnarvon, which trained every 2 weeks. And then that all eventually ended up tying into one of the larger militia units down in Perth. So they then used to sort of feed troops, and it was almost like a progression. People would start training locally and then sort of enlist properly and go on to serve in the war.
Is there any evidence of the fear of a Japanese invasion, as there was down here in Perth and certainly closer to the coast, after the attacks on Darwin and Broome? The anniversary of the attack on Broome is actually today in 1942. Was there any evidence of Carnarvon fearing and making maybe provision for a possible Japanese attack?
There absolutely was. I think it just goes to show that it was more I think Australia was in fear, especially after Darwin got bombed. I think it was very much a war that we thought was being fought overseas. But after Darwin was bombed, it wasn't long in Carnarvon they had a compulsory blackout of all motor vehicle and street and house lights. They were talking about camouflaging fuel depots. They're actually devising evacuation plans that if Australia was invaded from the coast, how they would move people further inland. So it was definitely a very real fear. Another thing we've sort of picked up on, especially from going through newspapers, is that even though obviously they were fearing this in Carnarvon, that was obviously being feared a lot more in places like Perth. And we actually have sort of an influx of people into Carnarvon after Darwin was bombed, which was a lot of, parents and parents-in-law and all of this sort of stuff who were living in Perth, who all of a sudden thought, oh, hang on, I'm just going to duck up to Carnarvon for a while because it's possibly a little safer.
They'll never find us up there.
Well, maybe a little later.
Now, I guess in the wake of that, after World War II, things started to change really all around Australia, in particularly in farming areas, as people started to get cars, the roads got better, the farming equipment got better, so people could have larger farms, or they didn't need so much manpower. They could do a lot more things with the mechanical instruments that were available to them. So the population started to drift a little bit, didn't they? And towns started to lose things. A bank here, a newspaper there, a guest house, those sorts of places. Did similar things happen in Kanama? People could drive, to a bigger town not too far away to do their banking or shopping, and that still continues to this day.
It definitely did. I mean, especially as agricultural advances were made, farms definitely started getting bigger, probably actually from the second half of the 1930s, I think that started. I know we all see it as a recent thing, but I think it had its infancy quite a long time ago. And, so a lot of as agricultural advances were made, farms got bigger, populations started to drop. The population was still quite significant in the 1950s. We actually had a second round of soldier settlement in the 1950s when...
After the Second World War?
Yeah. Okay. So there was a huge property that sort of partially in Kanama, partially in Karoo, Bunjil, Latham, and a little bit in Prendri as well, which was the property of owned by Gus Leiby, who was quite a builder of renown. He built His Majesty's Theatre and a number of other buildings in Perth, and also a couple of buildings over east and in Europe as well. He then later went into farming, and he ended up with a property in those sort of overlapping those districts I mentioned, which was about 55,000 acres in size.
Yeah, he was up Wallanyu way as well, wasn't he?
He also had, I think about 20-something thousand acres around Woburn.
Yeah, he really pioneered that broad acre farming, I think, with harvesters and things like that, and said, we can grow much more wheat on one farm here. And, he was quite a man, wasn't he? I think the Peninsula Hotel in Maylands is another of the buildings that he built and designed, yeah.
But so after he actually died, I think it was in the early 50s or late 40s, and... those who inherited his estate sold it to the government, and that was also carved up into smaller properties for soldier settlement, which probably went a little bit against his grand vision and dreams, but it most certainly did bolster the local population again.
Did Kanama ever have a high school?
It has a high school now, high school, which just goes to year 10, though.
Okay, so the kids didn't need to leave there. They could do pretty much their entire education in Kanama.
Well, could go up to year 10 or what used to be your, junior certificate. So a lot of people would still go away to boarding school for year 11 and 12. And then even now you still have a lot of people who think it's, better for their kids to settle in before year 11 and 12, so they go a couple of years earlier as well.
Yes, that's certainly been a trend, hasn't it, over recent years? But the trouble is, a lot of them get a taste for city life and never come back. Or come back for holidays and say, look, I'm not going to live and work here, I'm going to go and live in the big city.
Yeah, I guess that happens in all country districts. Not everyone's necessarily made for country living and farming. I myself actually live in Perth, so I can't argue to buck that trend.
No, I notice your name's popped up in the Royal WA Historical Society. I don't know if you're on a committee there or something, or I saw your name, I've seen your name in a few newsletters, so it's great to see that you're taking or brought your passion for history with you to Perth.
As a member of the Kanama Historical Society, actually then sit on the Royals Affiliated Societies Committee, which sort of represents the historical societies of Western Australia. So by living in Perth but being a member of a regional historical society sort of gives me the opportunity to bring a regional voice to what would otherwise be probably a very metro-based committee.
And are you still involved with the expansion of the website?
Absolutely. We've actually in the process of doing quite a massive expansion at the moment. We got some funding from the Department of Culture and the Arts last year to create another 6 virtual exhibits.
Wow.
To put on the website. So we already had 3 before, which were on the McPherson family, ready-made farms, and one on milk, cream and butter, which is sort of on domestic dairying. And we've just added one a couple of weeks ago on the Midland Railway, and we actually, another one went live today, which is on toys from the 1940s and 1950s.
Oh, I looked at that today. I didn't realise it only appeared today, but it's fantastic. People will love that because we all remember the toys we played with the children back in those days, and, you know, they were made of wood or they were made of tin. Metal in those days. There was no plastic, of course. That probably began to come in a little bit later. But there's some fantastic and the beautiful photos of them all. And, yeah, it's on a section of the website called Virtual Museum. And as you mentioned, there are several sections which go into great detail but have wonderful photos of old artifacts of people, of equipment, buildings in the town, some of the homesteads we've talked about. It is a bloody unbelievable sight, Andrew. I've got to say, I haven't seen anything else like it in all the websites I've looked at for towns all around Australia. And it just, you keep expanding it. And it's a great credit to you and the other members of the Historical Society up there that so much of this information has been gathered and sorted and put onto the website, and people have looked and asked questions and gone and checked whether that's right, cross-checked things, gone to the newspapers, and it's just fantastic the amount of information is there, and you really get a tremendous feeling about what life has been like in Carnarvon for the whole time, from back in the 1860s up until the present day. So I certainly commend you on that. That's fantastic that that continues to grow, and people can enjoy that whether they've ever been to Carnarvon or have any interest at all. There's much there that's just social history that could be transplanted to any other town in Australia, really, and it's a fantastic website. It really is. So I congratulate you and the other members on continuing to expand it.
No, thank you very much. It's your words actually mirror or a portion of them. A couple of years ago, a curator at the National Museum, apparently one of the ways they sometimes look for their exhibits is they jump onto Google, and they'd Googled soldier settlement and our site had come up, and sort of as a very direct consequence of that, there's now actually a portion of the National Museum's permanent gallery called Landmarks is actually on soldier settlement in Carnarvon after the First World War. And it was actually, he said a similar thing at the opening, where there's nothing else like it in Australia. So, no, we're definitely very, very proud to be sort of filling that niche a little bit.
Yeah, oh, no, it's fantastic. And the other good thing is that people can add their own stories to it, so you can read, look at the virtual museum, look at that section, the toys section, if you like, or the section on the McPhersons or any other area. The butter you mentioned brought back some great memories from me, having grown up in a dairying area in Victoria. But so people add things, and I saw a post from a lady who's I think her mother had worked for the McPhersons at some stage, so she had some knowledge of what life was like there for them, and so that's all added. So you can get, I mean, you know, the contributions can come from people who may well be living on the other side of the world but have some connection with Carnarvon.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the real beauty of it, is that it does sort of become almost a collaboration, and there is the opportunity for people wherever they are to sort of discover the content of the site, you know, through searching things that may actually not even mention Carnarvon. Most of the hits to the site come from people doing Google searches, and it's actually really interesting that only 3% of them actually include the word Carnarvon. So we're definitely dragging in a lot of traffic from people looking for family members and all sorts of other things.
Yeah, I imagine so. Yeah, well, there's so much information there that Google would steer them in that direction because it's so comprehensive, even if it's something that's not unique to Carnarvon. But the website is simply carnarvon.com.au. And, yeah, have a look through it all. It's fantastic information. You can find out anything that was ever in the newspapers about dances that happened years ago, funerals, sporting events, all sorts of things, people taking up land, people having children. But the virtual museums, which is one section of the website, which is a newer section, are just fantastic. And you'll learn lots about life in rural Australia, wherever it may have been, through the Carnarvon site. And I'm sure that's why why people are finding it. But Andrew, look, it's been great talking to you again. I really appreciate you joining us. And if we'd known you were in Sydney and it was going to be 2 o'clock in the morning for you, we would have said we'll leave it till next week. But it's been fantastic talking to you, and I really appreciate you giving us your time so generously. I hope you have a good time over there and a safe trip back.
I will, thank you.
Good on you. That's Andrew Bowman. Andrew is a member of the Kahnemar Historical Society and the virtual curator. So he's the man who really does most of the work and has done on the website and continues to do that despite the fact that he no longer is a resident of Kahnemar. Gee, if every town had a historian with that sort of passion, we would be the best documented country in the world.